It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a strange, kind of unexpected festival in Wisconsin, a Gator Fest.
But first, we're talking with a guest who says the United States is overreacting to the risk of attack by Al-Qaeda.
The United States shut down almost 24 diplomatic posts in the Middle East last week in response to a terrorist threat. Apparently, American intelligence intercepted a conference call between Al-Qaeda leaders. In the call, there were, again, apparently references to an upcoming attack.
John Mueller is a political scientist at Ohio State University and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's also the co-author of Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Benefits, Costs, and Risks of Homeland Security. He joins us now to discuss why he thinks the Obama administration is overreacting. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So why do you think the U.S. is overreacting to this potential attack?
Well, I can't be really sure, obviously, because you don't have the full information, but these sort of generalized warnings in the past have generally not panned out. There's been a long history of them, particularly during the Bush administration, there's going to be an attack before the next election and so forth. And no attack took place, no attackers were found, and even if the warning deterred an attack, you'd expect an attacker to wait a couple months and then do something. None of that happened, and this seems to fit in this pattern. So unless there's the information that's been out now certainly doesn't suggest the extreme measures that have taken place, which are really quite costly. I'm prepared to be refuted in that if they really do say that there's good information that they're based on, but so far certainly so far the information has been very suggestive that they've overreacted.
Mm. Well, and in that instance with President Bush, there were some accusations that he was using the terror threats as a political tool. Do you think there's a potential motivation along those lines with this information?
Well, there may be. I think there may be sort of a Benghazi syndrome going on, that was pretty traumatic for the administration, not only because of the tragedy itself, of course, but also for the high political costs that it entailed and it still entails in many respects. And so it seems sort of suspicious, as this whole thing that we have to now protect all our embassies and because we had one attack, last year and two attacked about 15 years ago in Africa. That's a fairly big extrapolation, but I put it more sort of at a position of unwarranted jumpiness. That would be my suspicion, rather than at a sort of conspiracy idea or political idea.
So is it unwarranted, though? I'm thinking about the Benghazi thing because President Obama has really been under a lot of scrutiny for his reaction, for that situation as a whole. So is there a double standard there?
Yeah, well, there's the tendency you basically try to shore up the last whatever's in the inbox. So if someone gets on a bomb with a bomb in their underwear, then you suddenly have a big war on underwear or on shoes or whatever. And the most traumatic thing they've had is an attack on an embassy. So therefore, they're very sensitive about protecting embassies. In this case, there seems to be information that something might happen in Yemen, but not in all those other places. So it seems really pretty extreme. The one thing I would say is that Obama administration has actually been really pretty good at toning down the rhetoric compared to the Bush administration, particularly the early Bush administration. He's dropped the global war on terror label, and he's also not spouting things about how three people setting off a bomb someplace presents an existential threat to the United States. So the rhetoric has really improved. So one thing you could say, and I can't refute this one way or the other, is that if they really are concerned about this, it comes from a record in which they have not been issuing a lot of hysterical, panicky proclamations. So that leads me to suspect that maybe there is a lot more to it, but certainly, as I indicated, the information so far doesn't suggest that's the case.
And in your mind, do you feel that the American people are a bit desensitized to this issue? Even if you think back to the Bush administration, we had the color scale to tell us, it's an orange level, it's a red level. So when we hear about threats today, are we taking them as seriously as we should?
We've maybe taken them too seriously, given the the amount of damage that terrorists do. An American's chance of being killed by terrorism is about 1 in 3.5 million per year. Chance of being killed in an automobile crash is about 1 in 8,000 per year. And so it should be put in that sort of context. It doesn't mean there's no problem, but it's not exactly a major one. And so there may be a certain amount of desensitization. There's certainly a lot of cynicism about this, in the press and in comments and articles in the press. And so that may be something of a change from the olden days where people got more hysterical. But basically, the principle should be scaring people without good reason is a really bad policy, because fear, has bad health consequences, has a lot of can be very disruptive. In this case, the main costs probably are from just the evacuations of embassies and so forth, and the costs and difficulties for those people directly. There's no fear, I suppose, within the United States, since none of the threats in this case seem to embody concerns about something that might happen in the United States itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we shutter the doors of embassies around the world, what kind of message is it sending to the jihadists and other terror groups like Al Qaeda? And what are they thinking?
Well, one thing, there's been a few sort of blogs and stuff on this from some of the jihadists. They're sort of celebrating in the sense that all you have to do is, have a bit of chatter on the internet, and the United States, launches into these self-destructive antics. And so that's probably going to encourage them to do even more of this. The fact that they should surely be aware, even before the NSA revelations, that all their communications are being scrutinized as much as possible, means that, if they're going to be listening to us, maybe we should give them something to listen to. So the possibility of a whole lot of disinformation, so-called chatter and so forth, is certainly out there. But I don't think that's really a brand new thing for them. I mean, Osama bin Laden said about 2004, it's really crazy. Basically, all we have to do is go to some country and wave a flag and scream Al-Qaeda, and the United States comes down on that area like a ton of bricks. We're going to bankrupt the United States. So this way, all we have to do is sort of run around and shout a few places. That's obviously a considerable exaggeration. But the basic idea that overreaction helps, plays into the terrorists' hands and is also extremely costly is sound. In the book Terror, Security, and Money, we try to calculate how much money has been spent, increased funding on security for the United States since 9/11. And this is just a domestic. It doesn't have anything to do with the wars overseas. And there's over $1 trillion of increased expenditures over the levels that were in place on 9/11. That's a very large amount of money, obviously, and it has not really been very carefully scrutinized, including by the Obama administration.
Hmm. So, well, going back to what you were saying about overhearing some chatter, quote unquote, those are your words. I'm wondering, how do we know, though, that we're overreacting or that it is just a bit of chatter? That's what we've been told, that they've intercepted this telephone conversation. But we don't know the extent of it. And the only people who do seem to be the terrorists themselves and the person who was tapping that wire.
Yeah, just the track record is pretty bad. I mean, if you look at some intelligence reports after 9/11, intelligence was telling people that we think there's between 2,000 and 5,000 Al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. The number that has been found is probably definitely extremely close to zero. You had John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, saying that Al-Qaeda is going to attack by the end of the year. Heard all this chatter and so forth, and their preparations are 90% complete, and nothing ever came of it. So there's been a lot of this proclamation going on all the way back to 2001, and very little of it has panned out to mean much of anything. There have been attacks, just a handful, of course, including obviously the thing in Boston recently, but that didn't have anything to do with the warnings or anything. Just a few people got together and eventually set off a bomb or did some shooting.
So do you think the administration's reaction to this will be perceived as weak to our foreign allies?
Yeah, it might be either weak or hysterical or irresponsible. That would be the danger, or foolish. Obviously, if it turns out that they're really onto something big and they're able to foil it, then the administration will look pretty good. But barring that, it's probably not going to be their best move from a public relations standpoint.
So in your mind, what is the appropriate reaction to threats like these?
Well, generally speaking, if you've got really good intelligence, you should get it as good as possible and then move on it. And they frequently have done that. They've broken up a lot of plots that were sort of moving along, both in this country and overseas. That doesn't take a lot of it. You don't make big public pronouncements about it. You simply basically arrest these guys, and then you hold a press conference and explain what you've done. That doesn't really scare people. It's not empty warnings saying that, you know, you have to look everywhere and worry about, you know, over your shoulder all the time. It doesn't exaggerate the threat. It just simply shows what they've got. And so issuing broad threats, warnings, rather, that are very inspecific, like there's something going to happen, we don't know where or when or how or who, not productive. I mean, if people hear the warnings, they can become afraid, but there's no information about what they could do because you don't know what the target is going to be. So working on operable intelligence is a good idea, but just sort of broad warnings do not seem to be very productive of anything.
Well, thank you, John, so much for shedding some light on that. That was John Mueller. He's a political scientist at Ohio State University and senior fellow at the Cato Institute.
Coming up, we'll look at Wisconsin's annual Gator Fest. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time now for another installment of Curious Wisconsin, where we answer the little mysteries you might encounter as you travel through the state.
This question comes from Paul Erickson of UW-Platteville. He joined us a while back to tell us that the big M on a hill near Platteville stands for mining.
His question was, why does the town of Leon, which is near Sparta, have an annual Gator Fest when Wisconsin is not really alligator territory? We called up Gator Fest founder Sharon Folsey to find out.
Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, I know there aren't a lot of alligators in Wisconsin. What gave you the idea to have a Gator Fest in Leon?
Well, first of all, Leon, Wisconsin is just 3 miles south of Sparta, and it's a really small town. We have maybe 25 houses. You know, it's not a very big place. So, yeah, my daughter was visiting in Florida in May of 2002, picked up a newspaper that had said that Leon, Wisconsin was in an uproar because they had a pet alligator that kept getting loose.
Okay.
And it said that they did a petition, the health inspector was called, they mandated that this family build a 6-foot-high fence. I mean, it was really a long thing about Leon, Wisconsin, having alligators. Well, we don't have a health inspector, we don't have a petition, and we don't even have a 6-foot-high fence. So I know we didn't have gators.
All right.
I sent USA Today a letter explaining all of this, and they basically sent me a letter back saying, no, they were correct, they stood by their reporting, and we were wrong. So a group of us women were sitting around talking one night and decided, well, hey, if they say we got gators, let's have some gators. So there was a band at that time out of Green Bay Area called Otis and the Alligators. So we were just going to book that band and have it down behind the local pub and just have music, and that was it.
Well, I got to ask you, you were sitting around talking. Was alcohol involved in the decision to go after a Gator Fest?
Well, of course. And it was a bunch of women talking, too, you know.
Uh-huh.
Which sometimes, you know, guys think we come up with some pretty goofy ideas.
So you went after the Gator Band. How did that pan out?
Well, we were going to do it in August, and we booked it, and then in July they called and said that their band was disbanded. They no longer had a band. Oh, my goodness. Then what are we going to do? So we had to dream up some other activities to do besides just music. So that's how the whole celebration got started. And we decided to have a parade, but Leon doesn't have a street that's long enough to have a parade. So our parade stands still, and the people have to walk by. We also are going to have a ball tournament because softball is big in rural communities. But we thought we'd do it differently, and all of the players have to use plastic laundry baskets instead of gloves. So that turned out to be a real popular event. We now have 3 days of ball tournament, laundry basket softball tournament, and it's full every year. Just a real big hit.
Now, with the standstill parade, do people make floats to stand still in the parade?
Oh yes, yeah. They bring their floats. Even Oktoberfest from La Crosse, they bring their big float, you know, with all their music and their dancers. And we have local Cash and Fall Festival. All of the local festivals bring their floats. And then, like people say, it's kind of nice because then the viewers can talk with the people that are on the floats. And like for the fire department and the ambulance, the kids can get up in there and look at everything. So it's just a win-win situation.
Now, this will be the 11th year coming up that you've done Gator Fest.
Yes.
How has it grown over the years? Are people catching on?
Oh, yes. When we started, everybody laughed at us. You know, they thought we were pretty goofy. But every year we try to do something new, a new event, a new activity, so that it's not stagnant, so that it's something new and exciting every time. Now we have food, lots of food, including gator meat. We have...
real gator meat.
Yeah, real gator meat. And that's a pot. We sell out of it every year. We have pancake breakfast, you know, the normal things. Plus, we have Gator Toss, which we sell tennis balls with numbers on, and then at a certain time of the day, the people have to throw these tennis balls into this pond. Whoever gets in the middle of the pond wins the money, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of fun activities. This year, we're going to have a kids' tractor pull. We started out having a car show. That didn't go over too well, so now we have a tractor exhibit, farm tractor exhibit,
uh-huh,
with antique tractors. That goes over real good. We have live music, of course, Friday night and Saturday night. That's always popular. Craft show, that's been growing every year. So there's something going on for everybody all 3 days.
A lot of towns have their annual festival, and I think a lot of people really look forward to those. Is this something that you think has helped create an identity in Leon?
Oh, definitely that. Yeah, a lot of people didn't even know where Leon was. And, you know, we would take our float to other parades, and they kept asking, where's Leon? Where's Leon? You know, so, oh, definitely that. We have a lot of people that come back just because it's family, you know, they left there and now they're coming back for their reunions or whatever. Plus, we have a lot of new people every year that come. And we do get out there and we promote it quite a bit too. So it's something different, you know, it's not the normal run of festivals. And just now, this past week, Malvina, which is located just a few miles south of Leon, had their frog jumping days. So we got frogs in Malvina, and then we got Black Squirrel Days in Norwalk or Wilton, and then, of course, gators in Leon. So we've got a lot of animals.
But there are still no real alligators in Leon, no matter what the USA Today tries to tell us.
Right. Well, we get the La Crosse Area Herpetological Society to bring over their reptile exhibit, and they bring a little gator with them.
All right.
So
okay.
We always have a gator.
All right. Well, anything you're looking forward to at the event this year?
Good weather. We've never been rained out. Never been rained out. We've got 23 entries in our parade, so unless we extend the street, that's as many as we can put in there. And everything's ready to go.
Are you going to be in the parade?
Oh, I have to be the part of the chairman that gets it lined up. So,
gotcha.
Last year I was the parade marshal. Oh, that's another thing we do. We have a parade marshal every year. The first year we had three of them. You know, we got such a big parade, we had to have three marshals. Now we have two, at least two. So that's always kind of fun too, because those are usually pillars of our community, you know, that we select to be parade marshals. So, yeah, it's
and
fun.
And then when you're done, do you wind up at the tavern where it all started?
No, we usually end up there at the beer hall at the Gator Fest, you know. But then we have meetings at the tavern, and we still get them involved. And the Tavern League always has their float in the parade. So we keep everybody going.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Sharon. I appreciate
sure.
it.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Sharon Folsey, founder of Gator Fest in Leon, Wisconsin. It takes place August 23rd through the 25th.
That was our Curious Wisconsin segment. Is there something you're curious about in Wisconsin? Email your question to centraltime@wpr.org or call our toll-free hotline. The number is 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. We'll try to answer your question on a future show.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, joins us to round up the top state news of the week.
And a new book encourages us to do cool stuff. I cleaned up the language there.
And we'll hear how we can subscribe to a regular sampling of art.
That's tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The most recent data available from 2007 show that about 2.7 million children in the United States are taking ADHD medication.
Many children go on the medication after having difficulty concentrating on classroom activities and performing poorly in school.
However, a growing body of evidence is showing that ADHD medication may not actually improve classroom performance for kids who have symptoms of ADHD.
Dr. Lily Hechtman joins us now. She's professor of pediatrics and psychiatry and director of research for the Division of Child Psychiatry at McGill University. Dr. Hechtman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, tell us how these drugs work. What do they do? Things like Ritalin and Adderall.
Well, I think they are stimulants, and contrary to one's intuitive feelings, they actually help the child concentrate. And that is really the only thing that they do. And in your introduction, you mentioned that many children on the medication do not improve in their grades, and that may be because that is not the only thing that they may require. Because improving your concentration is helpful, but if you are very behind in a particular subject, simply improving your concentration isn't going to get your grades up. If you have a learning disability, you need input which addresses that learning disability, and improved concentration is not going to do that. So I think that the fact that children who have attention deficit disorder and who may in fact benefit from the medication may also need other interventions because they may have additional difficulties to their attentional problems needs to be kept in mind.
Well, some studies show that ADHD medication can enhance memory. So isn't that relevant to a lot of the schoolwork too? And do we see any improvement there?
Well, I think if you're concentrating better, then you're going to absorb the material better and memorize it or remember it better. But if you have a learning disability, it won't improve because you really need remediation in the area that you have the disability in, with whether it's math or reading or whatever. So I don't think the medication... People may have, for example, excessive expectations of the medication because the medication can't always do it all.
Do you think there's a sense, an overestimation of how effective the medication would be all by itself? So the attitude is, okay, this kid's had a problem for a while, we're giving them medication, and that's all we need to do, and then we're done there?
Yeah, I think there's the expectation that the medication will solve all the problems, and that is not often the case.
Well, what can doctors do to help educate parents about the true efficacy of ADHD medications?
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that children may have additional difficulties in addition to their attentional problems. So they may have, for example, 20% of children with attention deficit disorder also have a very specific learning disability. And parents being aware of that should explore the fact whether or not their child has an additional learning disability. So that's one problem. The other problem that parents need to be alerted to is that often children get promoted from one grade to the next without really having mastered the material of the preceding grade. So children may be in grade 5, but doing arithmetic really at a grade 3 level. And that discrepancy causes children a lot of difficulty, and medication is not going to magically solve that. So where children are at in key subjects, where they actually are functioning in these subjects, is very important to determine. Whether or not they have a specific learning disability is important to determine. And these difficulties need to be addressed because medication is not going to do the trick there.
So before we start thinking about medication, how early can we start to diagnose something like ADHD and these learning disabilities you say often accompany it?
Well, you know, I think that most preschoolers are very active and they're very inattentive, and that is normal for preschoolers. And so that it's really rare that the diagnosis is made before children begin school. There are the exceptions. There are some children who really stand out in preschool and stand out in kindergarten as not being able to sit still, as not being very attentive, and they're out of the norm of their classmates and their peers. But usually it's in grades 1 and 2 that the difficulties really become clear and the children get referred.
It seems that more and more children are being diagnosed with ADHD. Is that true? And if so, why is that?
Well, I think the people are more aware of the condition. There is effective treatment, and so it's on people's radars. It's on the radars of teachers. It's on the radar of parents. It's in the news. So the increased awareness, both of educators and parents, probably is one of the reasons. I don't think the absolute incidence has increased, but I do think that people's awareness about the condition, the fact that it should be diagnosed and diagnosed early and should be treated early, is certainly there. People are more cognizant of that, and I think it results in greater referral numbers.
Is there a way that a parent might be able to discern whether they have a child with ADHD and maybe just a hyper kid or you know, a high-energy child?
Well, I think that this is why many cases, they are not diagnosed until they're in school. And so most children, even if they're high-energy children, really can sit through a period in the classroom. The truly hyperactive child cannot. They're very fidgety. They get up from their seat. They walk around the classroom. They can't really pay attention for more than a few minutes. And they really stand out as being different from the majority of the other children in that class.
There's been some controversy over the years, accusations that we're over-diagnosing ADHD, over-prescribing drugs, including from state legislators here in Wisconsin over the years. Do you think maybe the pendulum has swung too far and we're too quick to prescribe?
Well, you know, I think the key is that it's not a diagnosis that should be made lightly, that these children need to be thoroughly assessed because there are physical problems that can mimic ADHD, and they have to be ruled out. Things like, for example, hyperthyroidism or other difficulties. As I said, the child who has this very significant learning disability but does not have attention deficit disorder may be diagnosed with attention deficit disorder because they have difficulty paying attention because they don't comprehend the work that is being presented. And then they get restless and more active and inattentive in class, not because they're hyperactive, but because they do not comprehend the material. So it is not a diagnosis to be made lightly. These children need a good medical workup. They have to have their hearing and vision tested so that the medical workup is important and the psychological workup is also important. They have to have normal IQ. They have to have not very significant learning disabilities. And all of these things have to be looked at before the diagnosis of ADHD can be made.
Hmm. Are there alternative treatments or even complementary treatments that could be coupled with the standard ADHD medications?
Well, I think that people now are beginning to appreciate that other kinds of interventions, in addition to the medications, may be helpful for these children. So organizational skills, study skills, time management skills, all of these types of activities which are deficient in children with ADHD really help them perform in school in a better fashion because they're more organized, they're more on top of things, they can study better, etc.
Do kids, or as they turn into adults, outgrow these medications?
Well, outgrow the medication or the condition?
Either.
Well, what happens is that a certain proportion of children, what happens with them is that they develop skills strategies to deal with their difficulties. And so when you see them in adolescence or adulthood, they no longer meet the criteria for the condition. But that is really the minority. In adolescence, it may be 10 or 15%. In adulthood, it may be 20 to 30%. So the vast majority of people with ADHD, children with ADHD, go on and continue to have symptoms of the syndrome in adolescence and in adulthood. And they don't outgrow the condition, but they also don't outgrow their responsiveness to the medication, because adolescents and adults can be treated with these medications, and they are equally effective.
We'll talk more with Dr. Lily Hechtman. She is a professor of pediatrics and psychiatry. She's also director of research for the Division of Child Psychiatry at McGill University.
You can join the show at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Interested in hearing your experiences as an educator, maybe, or as a parent, as a physician. How often do you see cases of ADHD come through? Do you think the drugs are helpful? Do you think, as some do, that they're overused? 800-642-1234. I should point out we are not looking for anyone looking for a diagnosis of anything. Not a good way to do it in a brief phone call. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're talking about ADHD medications and whether they have an impact on school performance for children.
Our guest is Dr. Lily Hechtman, professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at McGill University. We'll get to your calls in just a couple of minutes. But first, Dr. Hechtman, we saw an estimate in a Wall Street Journal article that as much as a fifth of all ADHD medication is diverted or shared with other people who don't have prescriptions, don't have a diagnosis. Why are people wanting to get hold of this medication?
Well, I think it depends on the age group. It would be certainly not that kind of figure in the child age group, probably higher in the adolescent, and probably highest in the college-age student. And in the college-age students, it is being used to help people concentrate for long periods of time for exam purposes, etc., when they do not have ADHD. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's being diverted or misused.
What are the dangers of taking the medication if you don't have a prescription for it?
Well, I think that the dangers are similar to the ones that exist for people who do get a prescription, in that these medications are not without their side effects. They increase blood pressure and pulse. They decrease appetite. They can present with headaches or stomach aches or, delayed onset of sleep. I think it's one of the reasons people who want to stay up long hours and study take them, actually. So they have a series of side effects, and those side effects are there for the people who do not have ADHD as much as for the people who do. And I think the big difference and the danger is that when a physician prescribes the medication, they do an assessment of the child or the individual to make sure that using these medications for those people is safe. Given their cardiac status, given their blood pressure, given their other medical issues. When they're taken by diversion, nobody has done an assessment of the medical state of that person. And if they have any cardiac problems or any blood pressure problems, and they take the medication on top of that, they may run into real difficulties.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Peter with us in Broadhead. Peter, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. So I was diagnosed with, I was probably one of the first kids diagnosed with ADHD back in the mid-'80s, mid-late 80s, and now my son is 10, and he's also been diagnosed with it. I was on Ritalin back then. I'm not sure what the name of the medication he's on is, but it's a newer one. And, you know, there are some side effects. One of the things that I remember was my principal in middle school asking me, you know, what I think would happen if he took my Ritalin. And I said, oh, man, I'd probably put you right to sleep, because that's what it did for me. It slowed me down. You know, the ADHD is not necessarily the inability to think or the randomness of thought that some people seem to think it is. It's that you have such intense focus on what you want to focus on that you can't focus on the other people's stuff.
Do you think, Peter, taking the medication as a kid helped you cope in school, got you through to adulthood?
Got me through until about my freshman year when I just didn't need it anymore.
Gotcha.
I think I took it from third or fourth grade until freshman year of high school, so about 10 years. Something like that, 8-10 years.
Gotcha, Peter. Thank you so much for sharing your experience. Appreciate your call. You can join the show at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talking to Dr. Lily Hechtman, professor of pediatrics and psychiatry, director of research for the Division of Child Psychiatry at McGill University.
We'll talk now with John in Appleton. Hi, John.
Yes, good day, and thank you for the great show. You know, I'm currently an education professional, teaching and being a counselor. Since kids and adults are all each complex, I wondered if the doctor has thoughts on the effect of changing one of the big dynamics that impact learning, and that is the calendar. Going to a year-round calendar with, say, a month off each season, I wonder what she thinks that effect would be on kids with special needs and learning, as well as the general population.
Dr. Hechtman, do you think that's something that might help?
Going year-round and having a month off every so often?
That's right. That's right, yeah.
And what do you think would be the benefit for children with ADHD in that kind of system?
Well, I think they would lose, or they would not have the summer loss that frequently happens, you know, from one grade to the next. I think they would have chances throughout the year for remediation, some more special attention during, say, the off months when the rest of the school is off. Those are the big two, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. They have not done that experiment, and certainly I think children with ADHD and learning disabilities, etc., do get and try, their parents do try to get for them a lot of additional support and additional help, be it after school, weekends, etc. The children themselves may resent not having a summer off, and there are some children who, in fact, use the summer to catch up. Parents arrange for them to get some tutoring, etc., during the summer to catch up. So, you know, it's an idea, and it could be beneficial, but there are ways that people deal with the handicaps these children have without that kind of change in schedule. But having said that, there have been experiments wherein particularly for the adolescent, and this is not just adolescents with ADHD, but all adolescents tend to stay up late. They have to get up early for school, and they're very sleep deprived. And there have been some jurisdictions where they have postponed the time of that classes begin, making them later in the morning, and thereby allowing the adolescents to sleep in a little bit more. And they have seen that the grades in those jurisdictions have increased when the adolescents, in fact, are able to get more sleep.
Thanks for that call, John. We'll talk next to Famaj in Stevens Point. Hi, Famaj.
Hello. Hi. I don't mean to denigrate the importance of this diagnosis. However, being a teacher of 30 years, I have seen that it has been overly diagnosed, and I believe that the impetus is from the parent. And it is the parent who sees that their child is not performing up to their expectations. Therefore, they must have ADD or ADHD. That's the only reason that their child must be doing so poorly. And so the district nurse comes in and does, you know, a diagnosis, and she says, well, she makes a recommendation to a physician.
Dr. Famage, I'm going to jump in because we're a little short on time. I think we take your point. Parental pressure to prescribe these drugs just because the kids' grades maybe aren't up to snuff, Dr. Hechtman.
Well, I think that whoever is prescribing should insist on a really adequate evaluation of the child, because the child may have low IQ and the medication is not going to do a thing. So I think that both in the interest of the child, a proper evaluation needs to be made. And, you know, the parents are rightly concerned about the child's low grades, but determining why he's having low grades is really important. So it's up to the professionals to do an adequate and complete evaluation and not to misdiagnose children who do not have ADHD.
Well, in our last 30 seconds here, what is the most important thing for people to understand about treating ADHD?
Well, I think the most important is that you have to have a very comprehensive evaluation to rule out things that are not ADHD but may give attentional problems, and then a very comprehensive treatment plan, of which medication is only one part of that treatment plan, but other interventions in terms of academic and social interventions are also needed by these children.
Dr. Hechtman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, you're very welcome.
I've been talking to Dr. Lily Hechtman, professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at McGill University.
The news is next, and then we'll discuss new Wisconsin legislation on drunk driving and what can be done to curb what some people are calling an epidemic. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.